Question 76 now, on the causes of sin in particular. First problem, is it possible for ignorance to be the cause of sin? That is to say, is it possible for us to be guilty of a sin because of ignorance? I will explain. Not every kind of ignorance is a cause of a sin, but that alone which removes the knowledge which would prevent the sinful act. That means it's a sin not to know the things you are supposed to know. Well, for example, it's not a sin for you not to know St. Thomas Aquinas. But it's a sin for me not to know St. Thomas Aquinas. Why? Because I'm a priest. It's not a sin for you not to know the science of confession, the confessional. But it's a sin for me to hear confession without having the knowledge of the science of the confessional. By consequence, ignorance is according, if you want, according the, we can say, the, our, according our duty of state, we can say, in one sense, okay? According our duty of state. Second article. Is ignorance a sin? I will explain. This is very important for, especially to answer all the people, for example, telling us, Father, I killed my baby, but I did not know it was a sin. Okay? Or Father, I'm using birth control pill, I did not know it was a sin. St. Thomas will answer. All are bound in common to know the articles of faith and the universal principles of right, and each individual is bound to know matters regarding his duty of state. Duty or state. That is to say, there is no excuses for articles of faith you are supposed to know according your duty. He said, and each individual is bound to know matters regarding his duty or state. That is to say, if you accept a duty in a state of life, you are obliged to know the things which pertain to this duty of state. By consequence, someone has not the right to be ordained as a priest if he knows he doesn't know the things he's supposed to know as a priest. Someone has not the right, the sin for someone to accept a job when he knows perfectly he doesn't have the knowledge required for this job. You understand? Oh. This is to answer the question of people telling us, for example, Father, I sinned in my job because I did not have the knowledge to do this job. The answer is, you do not have the right to accept this job if you know perfectly you don't have the knowledge for the job. By consequence, the only fact you do accept the job knowing you cannot fulfill it, it's in itself a sin. Okay. After he explains more, whoever neglects to have or do what he ought to have or do commits a sin of omission. Wherefore, through negligence, ignorance of what one is bound to know is a sin. This sentence is important. Ignorance, negligence of what one is bound to know is a sin. It's you have the same text in the Catechism of Saint Pius X. When he speaks about the sins against the first commandment, the first one on the line after sacrilege is culpable ignorance of the truth of the Catholic faith, he said in his catechism. Culpable ignorance of the truth of the Catholic faith, that means when you don't know the things you need to know in order to go to heaven. You need a minimum of knowledge to go to heaven. Yeah.
I had an argument today with somebody about God is not going to heaven. Okay? Unless the guy in the same grace, which...
Yeah.
Is there any good book that you could recommend for him? He is a Catholic. He believes in most of the stuff that I do, but he says he can't just accept that.
Just accept what?
He said if you were a good Protestant, a good Lutheran, or a good Methodist, and you lived up according to your religion, he feels that they would get to heaven.
If you live in a state of grace. Not if, for example, your religion is teaching you something against the natural law. For example, if your religion is telling you that abortion is okay. suppose you follow this religion and you have abortion because your religion tells you abortion is okay. In fact, it's a sin.
Because most of the Protestants say you can.
But of course, but this is against natural law. If something is against the natural law, the fact you follow a religion which tells you it's okay, that doesn't change anything, you are guilty, because your conscience will tell you it's wrong. You never let me believe, for example, I never believe that a woman can kill the baby, can kill her own baby, saying, I did not know I was doing something wrong. I don't believe. It's impossible for a woman. Because it's a part of your body, and you know perfectly it's your baby. They can, if you be brainwashed to such a way, they forget it, but deeply inside their soul, they know perfectly they are doing something right. Something wrong. It's like a gay, if you want. A gay knows perfectly he has not the right to live the way he's living. He will find excuses, if you want. He will say, but now it's accepted, but deeply inside his soul, he knows it's against the natural law. By consequence, it's a sin. You understand? Mm-hmm. Because it's against the natural law. Yes?
So if you practice birth control, that would automatically be a sin.
Birth control is totally different because it's indirectly connected with the natural law. Abortion is directly against the natural law. Birth control, I think you have now some people who really think it's okay. In fact, it's not.
Also, if they were to commit a mortal sin, if they had true contrition, would that be the equivalent of going to confession, or would they still go to hell?
No, because suppose you can see that when people get the knowledge. We have many, many women, for example, using birth control because a new order priest told them it's okay. In many cases. They ask, before using birth control, they go to the priest and they ask him, is it okay for me to use birth control pill? If they go with the intention to follow the advice of the priest, say, if the priest says, no, I will not, if the priest says, yes, I will, in such a case, there is no sin. There is sin for the priest, but not for them. In such a case, you can have people using birth control pill without knowledge of the evil of the thing, and by consequence, not a sin, because the sin is first in the will. But this doesn't work with natural law. Things going directly against the natural law, like to steal, like to lie, like to kill someone, you know deeply inside your soul, it's wrong.
But say like with the Protestant who was baptized, and who was a valid baptist,
yeah.
And say he killed someone.
Yeah.
Okay, now he had true contrition for the sin afterwards. Would he still be able to go to heaven?
It's always the same thing. If he can get what we call an act of perfect contrition, to be truly sorry for the love of God, it's possible. It's quite difficult for a Protestant.
No, he'll be sorry because he'll be punished.
You know, it's quite difficult, but it's always possible because God is obliged to give to each man the graces this person needs to go to heaven. Yes, Maura?
Theft and homosexuality are against the natural
law. Oh, yes. Of course,
so
yeah.
So what makes one more serious than the other?
Because theft is not against the nature. It's again, you see the distinction between against the natural law, against the law, and against the nature itself. You understand? Homosexuality, it's against the nature of the things. It's worse than theft. Against the nature of the thing.
Oh.
It's against our own nature. You understand? It's mm-hmm. against the natural law given to each human nature by God.
But stealing is against the natural law too.
Yes, but stealing, it's again, you have the distinction between what you are and what you have. To sin against what you are is worse than to sin against what you have. Because something you have, it's something added to your nature. Do you understand? On the contrary, an homosexual, for example, is someone fighting against his own nature.
And
a consequence.
Murder would be in the same vein as
yeah.
The personal sin, the personal, right? And the other one is acquired.
It's against, if you want, you destroy your own self, we can say. Do you understand?
I was talking to someone today and they said, well, would you rather have a son that was, or a child that was a thief or a homosexual?
What did you say?
Well, it's a thief. I'd rather be in jail than be a homosexual.
But of course, yeah.
And you call yourself a Christian?
But she, you were perfectly right.
Well, and then she went on to say, well, this is really perverse, but she said that at least homosexuality would have something to do with love.
If you, you are right to answer that, because to steal something, if you want, it's sin of weakness. Most of the time, it's weakness. Sin of homosexuality, it's malice. It's deeper. It's because of that, it's quite easy to remove tendencies to steal, very difficult to remove a tendency to homosexuality. Very, it's not impossible, but when we are dealing with people like that, especially during spiritual exercise, it's very difficult because they're obliged most of the time, if they want to change their life, to leave everything, to change from town, to go in another state, to go another place. It's very, very difficult. We have to recognize. It's possible with the grace of God. When we have poor guys like that, we tell them, first thing we have to do is to help them to use their brain again and to recognize it's a sin. Because they've been brainwashed, you know. Everybody is telling them, it's only a way of living. Some people, some priests will say, oh, it's a way of living, it's okay. You know the famous sentence, God loves gays too, what they say now everywhere. Or some will say, it's a sickness, you are sick. The first thing we have to explain to them is, it's not a part of your nature. You are not sick, you are a sinner.
But sickness of the soul.
Sickness, no, because many priests will say it's physical sickness, which is not true. It's not an intellectual sickness, it's a spiritual sickness. A gay is first of all a big sinner. And the first step, if you want, for us priests, is to help him to understand he is a sinner. By consequence, he's guilty of a sin, he has to remove it. Now you remove sins through confession.
Didn't you say before that a man can have a slight natural tendency toward...
Yes, but you can have natural tendencies that doesn't destroy the sin. It's like, a man who has, for example, natural tendencies to drink, for example. Because the fact, for example, his father was drinking constantly at home or something like that. He has natural tendencies. Natural tendencies doesn't mean that it's not a sin to drink. It's true that... you have, for example, not always, but very often, people with homosexual tendencies are coming from broken families, for example. Or have been involved first with drugs or with alcohol. Most of the time it starts like that.
Or a bad adult in younger years.
Yeah, but most of the time it's connected with alcohol. It's people drinking.
No, but it's mothers that want, say, a mother that wanted a girl, they got a boy and they...
No, there is also the fact, this is sometimes true, but it's only an accident, it's not something substantial. Mother of family giving a type of education which is too feminine for a boy. Okay, and this can lead to this type of problem, it's true. It's true, but it's only a natural inclination which must be destroyed. Don't forget that by nature we have the original sin. By nature, we have this formex peccati, say Saint Thomas, this source of sin. Yes?
I read somewhere where like 60 or 70% of homosexual men had a hatred for the mother, or they've never been able to form an attachment, they had a malice towards them. For some reason, they resent.
I think most of the time they are coming from unbalanced families, most of the time. Or bad companies, yes?
Well, if we have the source of sin inside of us, our concupiscence.
Yeah.
How do we distinguish when it's coming from inside us or when it's coming from outside us, like say for example, directly from an evil spirit or some source like that? How would you distinguish?
Because the three things are working together. The evil spirit, for example, will work with your bad tendencies. The evil spirit cannot work like that on nothing. If you have a temptation from the devil, temptation of the devil will come through the fact you have inside your heart a desire to disobey the law of God. You understand? It's always the same, always the same thing. Okay, by consequence, if you want to go back to Saint Thomas, he says that someone is guilty of a sin if he doesn't know the things he's supposed to know because of his duty of state. Mariette, for example, for us as a priest. And he said at the conclusion, what I already explained, vincible ignorance is a sin if it be about matters one is bound to know, but not if it's if it be about things one is not bound to know. Do you understand? That means, speaking about vincible ignorance, not to know the things, and when it's in fact very, very easy for you to get the knowledge of the things. He will say it's a sin to keep this ignorance inside your mind if you are supposed to know these things because of your duty of state. If you are not obliged to know about these things, you're not obliged, and by consequence, it's not a sin. Yes?
Well, if you're single, and would your duty of state encompass things you're supposed to know if you're married? Like, say you were a
Catholic. Excuse me? Well,
if you're, say you're single.
Yeah.
So your duty of state would mean that you'd have to know things about the marriage. You would have to know things
about your mind that. Yeah, of course not.
Okay, so if you were, like, say you were a single Catholic.
Yeah.
If you married a Protestant girl,
yeah,
and you married her in the church, and then afterwards you went to a Protestant ceremony or whatever, that would be excommunication, wouldn't it?
Yes, you mean excommunication in case like that.
But if you didn't know that this is not part of your state, it's not part of your duty of state.
No, because this is part of your catechism. If you know your catechism, you know because of your catechism you have not the right to get married with someone who is not from your religion. For a case of excommunication, you have many excommunications. One of the conditions is knowledge. For example, excommunication for abortion. Okay, each time I have a case like that in the confessional, someone is telling me, Father, I'm guilty of a sin of abortion, I will ask immediately, did you know the day of this abortion about the pain of excommunication? And if this person tells me, no, Father, I did not know, in such a case there is no excommunication because there is ignorance. There is still the sin. The sin is still there, but not the excommunication. Because for some excommunications, knowledge is required. For some, it's ipso facto.
So you would be excommunicated anyway, because you should have known that it was excommunicated?
No, because for things like that, you're not... If you did not know, in fact, there is no excommunication. But the sin, of course, is still there.
Okay?
Okay? Yes?
According to St. Thomas, it sounds like our Protestant friends, since their religion is heretical and their Bible is heretical and they're not getting the proper information through their church, are they are obliged and bound to learn the truths of the Catholic Church.
So it's the same thing. What we have to, I think we can answer like that, God will give to all these people the graces they need to find their way. We see that, for example, with the spiritual exercises. I saw that many times. When you have young adults, they are Protestants, they know there is something wrong with the Protestantism. They know it's an empty church. They are looking for the truth. God will always put them on the way of a good priest to help them, or will put them in contact with a good Catholic person who will lead them to the priest. I saw that many times. If they are really looking for the truth, they will find a way to find this truth. Do you understand?
So someone who was brought up, this argument was brought up to me, and I don't know how to answer it. But I was brought up Catholic. So I'm convinced of the Catholic faith. Obviously. But a Protestant is brought up Methodist and Buddhist or whatever.
Yeah.
Well, Buddhist, whatever. You know, they're brought up in that faith, lack of faith.
Yeah.
And they're convinced of it. And you couldn't really convince them of the Catholic Church. You know,
well, so the same thing. The answer, I think, is the same. Say, God will give to these people the knowledge they need. Or if they are really in a case of invincible ignorance, as long as they live in state of grace, they can be saved through an implicit baptism of desire. But it's quite difficult. Because, you know, for example, give you an example. Typical example, it's matrimonies for Protestant people. When Protestant people get married, most of the time, they don't have the intention to stay together. Because in the Protestant churches, indissolubility of the matrimony doesn't exist. Even if they preach about it, in fact, it's their mind that doesn't exist because, in fact, it's very easy to get divorced. You know? In such a case, most of the time, the matrimony is invalid. I just received a letter of Archbishop Lefebvre about that. I asked him a question about things like that, and he told me, you have the right to consider that all the matrimonies between Protestant people are invalid in front of God. Why? Because they don't have the intention to stay together. It's against the natural law. Yes?
Father, does the invincible ignorance apply to the Catholics regarding their faith?
No.
Doesn't.
No. Invisible ignorance, it's a case of someone who, in spite of everything, cannot have access to the truth. He's trying, but he cannot, but it's a case, I don't know, of someone who will kill someone. You suppose someone is hunting, okay? No. And he will kill someone by accident, okay? He saw something moving, he checked to be sure it was a rabbit or something. He checked everything, and in fact it was not. He made an invisible ignorance, he's not guilty of a sin. But suppose someone who is hunting, the example we can give, is hunting. He sees something moving very far away. He shoots and kills the guy. To me, Father, I was thinking it was a deer, but for him, it's not a deer, it's a guy. I killed someone. He's guilty of a murder because of invincible ignorance. You know, it was perfectly possible for him to wait before shooting. His duty was to wait, to check, to be sure there is nothing. But suppose a guy who tell me, Father, I checked everything, I was sure everything was fine, and finally I discovered after it was a man, and I killed someone. In such a case, it's invincible ignorance, it's no sin.
In the first case, the guy could have been overwhelmed by excitement and shot and...
Yeah, of course. It's true. It's true, but you have to see cases by cases. Mm-hmm. Okay? There's a general rule. It's like someone who is telling me, Father, I don't know, I fell asleep, for example, driving. I had a car accident, I killed someone. There's no sin. It's not a sin. Tell him not to worry, it's not a sin. You are obliged by the consequences to pay the insurance, to pay everything. No, but it's not a sin. Morally speaking, it's not a sin.
Except if he's wrong.
Excuse me?
Except if he's
wrong. No, but speaking about the guy who is falling asleep, it's a different case. If he's drunk, it's different because it's a sin to drink first, to drink too much. Second, it's a sin to drive when you know you are not capable to control your car. Yes.
But if you're falling asleep, shouldn't you know to pull off the side of the road and sleep?
So it's the same thing. Suppose a guy who knows he's too tired to drive and saying, I don't care, I go anyway. If he has a car accident and kills someone, he is guilty of this murder. Because it was implicitly, you say,
yes,
contained in the fact you drive when you're not supposed to drive. On the contrary, the guy falls asleep because he did not know he was too tired, he falls asleep, he kills someone, there is no sin. Okay. Do you have any more questions about that? This part is a little complicated. He says, after he explains a little more, question 76 again, the neglect to know or even the lack of consideration is a sin. And when you don't study the things you are supposed to study. And he explained more after, man sins actually only at the time at which the affirmative precept is binding. Say, you sin if you don't know the things you are supposed to know at the present moment, you sin. After he explains more about ignorance, we are now at question 76, article 3. Such like negligence, he says, renders ignorance itself voluntary and sinful, provided it be about matters one is bound and able to know.
Can you read it again?
Such like negligence renders ignorance itself voluntary and sinful, provided it be about matters one is bound and able to know. Say, when you don't know things you are supposed and obliged to know because of your duty of state. If you neglect to study these things, and because of that you are in trouble, it's a sin. Consequently, say, this ignorance be such as to be entirely involuntary, either through being invincible or through being of matters one is not bound to know, then such like ignorance excuses from sin altogether. Say, or because you have an invincible way, invincible obstacle, in spite of everything you try to do, you cannot know the things you are supposed to do. Or because this concerns a matter which is not your business. Okay, you are obliged to deal with something which was not your business, and you will provoke an accident, for example. Like someone, example we can give, for example, suppose someone in the plane, the pilot had a problem, and someone in the plane would try to drive the plane, but would crash and would kill everybody. Right? It's not a sin because he's not obliged to know how to drive a plane, except if he's a pilot. If he has a pilot license, he forgot how to drive the thing he's driving anyway. Of course, in such a case, he will accept by consequence all the consequences coming from the fact he's driving without license. Or driving, not knowing what he's supposed to know. The general rule stays: ignorance diminishes the sin. Okay. Rule. After you have all the rules, ignorance. If this ignorance is invincible, the ignorance destroys the sin. There is no sin connected with an invincible ignorance. Okay. If it's a vincible ignorance, it can diminish the voluntary, but never changing something which is a mortal sin into a venial sin. So if it's mortal, it's still mortal, even if you had an ignorance, if this ignorance is vincible. So it was very easy for you to remove the obstacle before sinning. Yes?
Say you're a doctor, yeah, and you're working in an emergency room, but you're a cardiologist. You haven't had too much experience in the emergency room. It's been a couple of years since you graduated from med school. You study up on it, but you don't have a really firm grasp of, say, trauma.
Yeah.
And someone comes in with trauma, and you misdiagnose. You do a mistake. Okay?
Yeah. Okay, fine.
Okay, and the person dies.
Yeah.
Now that was visible ignorance.
You have to see the cases. Suppose it was very easy for you to ask someone else to take care of the case. Because another physician was nearby, it was very easy for you to give a phone call and to ask before acting. Such a case, yes, it's a sin. Second case, it's an emergency. You're obliged to try to do something, if not the guy will die. You have absolutely no way to check what you are doing. You try the best you can. In fact, you made a mistake. You made a mistake in the diagnosis of the sickness, for example. The guy died, there is no sin. Okay, because always the same rule, the sin is first in the will. Okay. I repeat the sentence of Saint Thomas, which is important. Such like negligence renders the ignorance itself voluntary and sinful, provided it be about matters one is bound and able to know. Consequently, this ignorance does not altogether excuse from sin. If, however, the ignorance be such as to be entirely involuntary, either through being invincible or through being matters one is not bound to know, then such like ignorance excuses from sin altogether. Okay? Now, question 77. Of the cause of sin on the part of sensitive appetite. Let's say, is it possible to sin only because of our senses? Now, St. Thomas would say, the judgment of the reason often follows the passion of the sensitive appetite. When he speaks about sensitive appetite, that means the senses. Okay? And consequently, the will's movement follows it also, since it has a natural inclination always to follow the judgment of the reason. That is to say, our senses must be controlled by our will. If we refuse to control our senses through our will, we sin. Yes?
What about the case of rape?
In such a case, there is no sin because there is no voluntary. You don't want to sin.
But the person who raped you?
The person who is raped doesn't sin. The person who is doing something like that, of course, is sinful. She's sinful, but if it's always the same rule. The rule is this one: the sin is first in the will. You don't want to sin, there is no sin. You want to sin, even if finally you don't sin, because of circumstances, you cannot sin. As long as you wanted to sin at the beginning, you are guilty of sin. Even if the action did not occur. Yeah. Okay, I will explain. This is a little more complicated. The question is, this one is asking, is it possible for the reason, our intellect, to be overcome by a passion against its knowledge? Against its knowledge. So is it possible for someone to say, I sinned because the temptation was too strong? More or less is that. Okay? And we'll explain. A man who is in a state of passion fails to consider in particular what he knows in general. First, by way of distraction. Second, by way of opposition. Third, by way of bodily transmutation. We explain. This is to say, the meaning is that when, if the passion will destroy completely the use of your reason, you don't sin. Because in such a case, there is no voluntary character in the action. But if you put yourself knowingly in this passion, in such a case there is a sin. Suppose someone who is drunk by mistake. He doesn't want to be drunk. He's drinking something, he didn't know it was alcohol, for example, or he's speaking with someone, and finally he's completely drunk, he doesn't realize it. Once he's realizing it, it's too late. There's no sin. Even if after, by consequence, he will, for example, do stupid things, it's not a sin because he did not have the intention to get drunk. Now, second case. Suppose someone wants to be drunk, knowing that if he is drunk, he will do stupid things. The only fact he puts himself in a state of drunkenness will make him guilty of all the sins coming in consequence. Okay? But St. Thomas explained, a sin that arises from passion should be called a sin of weakness. It's not a sin of malice most of the time, but sin of weakness. He explains, the stronger the movement of the passion against the order of reason, the greater the weakness of the soul. Okay? If you have a very, very, very strong passion, if you have a slave of very, very strong passion, your soul will become weaker and weaker. There is a very interesting article, it's a question 77, article number 4. He will try to find the source of every sin. See, from where are coming all our sins? And the answer is very strange. The answer is self-love, he said. Self-love is the cause of every sin. Self-love, in fact, strictly speaking, it's pride. Yeah, pride. He said, the inordinate love of self is the cause of every sin. Inordinate self-love leading to the contempt of God reckons to be the cause of sin. It's the teaching of St. Augustine. I'm sure you know the sentence of St. Augustine. Two cities. First city is the love of self up to despising God. It's an earthly city. Second is the love of God up to despising yourself. It's a heavenly city. Okay? Everybody must love something. We cannot live, we have a sentence in my country, we say, man cannot live without idol. You need to worship someone. Or you worship the true God, or you worship the false God. If you don't worship the true one, you're obliged, even against your will, to worship a false God. Then we'll go deeper. How this self-love will work? And we'll ask a question. Is concupiscence of the flesh, concupiscence of the eyes, and pride of life fittingly described as causes of sin? You understand the word concupiscence? Concupiscence means? No. Concupiscere in Latin means to desire very strongly something. By consequence, concupiscence, you have, the church, you have three kinds of concupiscence. inside our soul after the after our original sin.
What you call the concupiscence, the name. Concupiscence. You have three of them. You have concupiscence of the eye, concupiscence of the flesh, and concupiscence of pride. Concupiscence of the eyes, it's a desire to possess the things. Concupiscence of flesh, it's a desire for all things of impurity. Concupiscence of pride, it's a desire of honor.
Or we say concupiscence of intellect?
Yeah, if you want. So I think Saint, Saint John used the word pride. It's the text of Saint John. All that is in the world, St. John, first epistle of St. John, first episode of St. John, all that is in the world, he said, is concupiscence of the flesh, concupiscence of the eyes, and pride of life. Pride of life. How to fight against that? To destroy, to remove the concupiscence of the eyes, which virtue we have to practice?
Poverty,
yes, of course. Poverty. Okay. If you are poor, you don't have one dime in your pocket, you can't have any concupiscence because you know you can't get anything. Second, against flesh.
Chastity,
yeah. And the third one? No.
Humility.
Obedience. Because if you are under obedience, you can't follow your own will. By consequence, you destroy pride. These are the three vows of the monks. Poverty, chastity, obedience. With poverty, you remove concupiscence of the eyes. With chastity, concupiscence of the flesh. With obedience, concupiscence of pride.
You mean obedience to God, then?
Obedience to God? No, obedience to your superior, too. Yeah. Obedience to your constitution.
Yeah.
Because when you are constantly doing the things because of obedience, you destroy pride. Okay, I remember an advice of our Bishop Lefebvre. He always told us as priests, don't preach somewhere if you have not been invited. He told us. Okay? Don't go to preach in a place where you have not been invited to preach. It's not good for a priest, he said, to, for example, to give a call to another priest, I want to go to preach in your parish. Because in such a case, you are not sure it's the will of God. You have always to wait. If someone else, suppose someone else is giving me a call. Father, I would like for you to come to preach in my parish. I did not ask. If someone was inviting me, what I have to do? To call my superior. To call my superior, Father Lede, to telling him, such a person is inviting me to preach in his parish. May I accept? If the superior says yes, and if I have been invited, such a case is not my will, it's the will of God, manifested through the superior. I'm obliged to be protected. So I can go, I will have the graces of state to preach according to what I have to do, and I will be protected from any, not any mistakes. I can do mistakes, material mistakes, but God is obliged to protect me because I did not look for itself. You understand? I saw that. We have an incredible example of in the Society of St. Pius X. We have a case, I know very well, of a priest, Society of St. Pius X, somewhere in the world. He wanted absolutely to have one parish. He wanted this parish very badly. He wanted to be pastor in this parish. He was second chair somewhere. He wanted this parish very, very badly. To be alone, without superior, and in charge of this parish. He worked through many, many ways, okay, asking all the people he knew to write to the superior in order for him to be sent to this parish. He works through many, many other ways to make pressure on his superior finally to change the mind of his superiors.
And after working like that during 6 months, finally, because of all these pressures coming from outside, he did provoke by himself. He has been appointed in this parish. He dropped his priesthood. He got his parish. He dropped his priesthood a short time after. He left completely everything. Why? Because he got a parish, which was a difficult parish, a big parish, without following the will of God. It was not the will of God, it was his own will. You understand? By consequence, God was no longer obliged to protect him. In fact, God withdrew the graces, withdrew his graces. The guy was trying to fight without graces and failed completely, you know. Because that's the point of the obedience for us is so important. If you are under obedience, you are protected by your superior. Even if your superior is sometimes asking to do something which is quite dangerous, you know. Yes?
What if you don't have obedience?
Well, because of that, in the Catholic Church, a priest without obedience, that doesn't exist.
But then, not a priest, say a lay person.
But for lay person, it's a little different. Because of that, don't forget that these three things, poverty, chastity, and obedience, are obligations for all people consecrated to God, but not for you. For us, priests, it's vow of poverty, vow of chastity, vow of obedience, or promise. For you, it's spirit of poverty, spirit of chastity, spirit of obedience. Which is a little different. You understand? Of course, for us, it's more easy. We can say it's more simple for us to go to heaven, because we are under superior.
Well, I thought you said at once that the priests in the society didn't take a vow of poverty.
It's true. In society, we are under vow of chastity. We have exactly vow of chastity, spirit of poverty, promise of obedience. Well, we are under vow of chastity because it's obligation by canon law. No one can be ordained as a priest without the vow of chastity. We are not under a vow of poverty because it's impossible in the world. Someone can be someone can be under a vow of poverty only if he is in a monastery, without any contact with the world. When you are inside the monastery, completely cut from the world, yes, you can be under a vow of poverty. For example, if I cannot be under a vow of poverty. If I am under a vow of poverty, each time I spent one dime, I'm obliged to ask my superiors. It's impossible.
And why do you say a promise of obedience instead of
a
vow?
It's a promise because it's a canonical title of the society. Society of St. Pius X is a religious society of common life without vows. It's the name, the title of part of the canon law. We are only under a vow of chastity. In fact, we are under a promise of obedience, which is for us as a vow. If you are strictly speaking, we are vow of obedience and vow of chastity. And spirit of poverty, if you want to be sure we practice a spirit of poverty, we are obliged, because of obedience, to follow some rules of poverty. We have very strict rules of poverty in the Society of St. Pius X. For example, even for me as a pastor of the parish, in the accounting of the account, for example, I have a bank account here for the house. First of all, I'm obliged to make a monthly report to my superiors with all the things I spent. All the income, all the expenses, how I spend them. Second, I have not the right to spend more than, I think it's $5,000 now, without special permission of my superior. We need to buy another car for the house next month. I've been obliged to call Father Nene to ask him permission. Okay. We have also plenty of other rules of poverty. For example, a priest cannot receive any salary. The only thing he can keep, it's a mass stipend for each day, that's it. If he receives, for example, a mass stipend which is very, very high, he can keep only the regular mass stipend and is obliged to give the difference to the house. If he says many masses in the same day, on Sunday, for example, he has not the right to keep the mass stipend for each mass. He can keep only for one and the other one for the house, you know, to protect us against greed. To have temptation to have too many things. We have also plenty of rules, for example, about our cars must be simple. He doesn't want for us to have very fancy cars, simple cars. Okay, simple life in our houses.
other rules, for example, to help us to practice the spirit of poverty, we have not the right during the week to visit, to have dinner with our faithful more than twice a month, avoiding to be in the same families. There is the constitution. Sunday is different because of the mission. But during the week, I have not the right to have dinner with the family more than twice a month, and avoiding always the same families. If I want already twice, I'm obliged to say no. But we have other rules of poverty, like no TV in our houses. It's forbidden for us to watch a movie, but not the right by constitution. All these rules, if you want to help us to practice the virtue of poverty. We have not the right to keep personal money. If any person is giving us a gift, the gift must go for the house and not for us, except you have exceptions only for very personal gifts, for example, for Christmas or, or for example, for your birthday. So yes, you can keep the money, but again, spirit of poverty will work in that. Archbishop Lefebvre is asking us in such a case always to use our personal money, if you want, to help the Society of St. Pius X. For example, I'm priest since 10 years. Well, I have all my mass stipends during 10 years. It's about, I don't know now, $15,000, something like that. Well, I keep that in a separate account because it's my money, I have the right to control it by constitution. But what I do, when we need to buy a car for the house now, as the money, what I do? We use my money to buy the car for Society of St. Pius X in order to avoid to go through a bank loan, and after the house will pay me back little by little. If I am moved in another place, which can happen anytime, if I have to buy a car for the house because I need a car, I will buy the car with my money and after ask the Society of St. Pius X the house to pay me back little by little. I keep some personal money according to our constitutions. But Archbishop Lefebvre is asking us to use this money for your for the necessities of the house. Of course, you have the right, we have the right as priests to use also this money for personal things according to the spirit of poverty. For example, we have a new rule now in society for all the priests who are living outside, outside of their country. We have the right for priests who are living in another country, we have the right to visit our families. It's forbidden now for us to go back to visit our families more than once every 2 or 3 years. Archbishop Lefebvre is asking us to avoid to go back in our families every year because it's too expensive. Because of the price of the tickets between New York, for example, and Paris. They say we have the right to go once every 2 or 3 years. In such a case, a ticket, of course, paid by the Society of St. Pius X. Okay? And these rules, of course, of poverty are very, very important. As long as we keep them, we keep the spirit of poverty, it's more easy for us to fight against the temptation. Because as soon, what's happening, as soon you don't follow the spirit of poverty anymore, what will happen? You will start having personal friendships. All the priests are gone like that, are destroyed like that. Okay? They start going always with the same family, one or two families. Constantly. The beginning is perhaps not, for us it's sinful, it's against our constitution. They try to go, we have priests, we lost priests like that. Every week, same family. And little by little, contacts are too frequent first, too sentimental, you know. Little by little, the parents always the same story. The parents would tell us, Father, you know, you are as our son. Fine. It's nice. They say that to help us to feel good. Father, we are so happy you come here so often because you are as our son. Feel at ease at home. Okay? And little by little, we go more and more. And finally, the priest will forget he's a priest at home. Because he will feel like in his own family. And the devil will get him like that. Or with a girl, most of the time with a girl of the house. When we lose, when even in the new church, when you lose a priest because of moral things like that, it's always the same story. They have been deceived because of particular friendship. Going always in the same family. And us priests, we have to be very careful first to follow our constitution. and for me as superior of the house to oblige the priest working with me to follow the constitution. Suppose you have no problem with the father of the taker for the young, but suppose I will discover that for example one of my priests is going too often in one family, I will be obliged to him and to forbid him under all the obedience. It's forbidden for you to go back in this family because you go too often. You know, it's quite difficult. But when we are under a spirit of poverty, we are protected. God is obliged to protect us. You know, it's the same thing here. We see that with the spiritual exercise. It's very important for us priests. If we act according to our duty of state, we are always protected. God will protect us. Okay, suppose, give you an example. Sometimes we have people who are coming here in the spiritual exercises who are big fishes. Okay, big sinners sometime to time. Well, God, if they come here to follow the spiritual exercises, God is obliged to give us the graces. Okay? Suppose you have, a very easy girl coming one day to follow the spiritual exercises. She's jumping from one boy to another guy constantly. She's coming to follow the spiritual exercises. Fine. God is obliged to give us the graces we need. Suppose after the spiritual exercise, you want to keep contact. Okay? I always say to the people, to the priest here, after the spiritual exercises, you are no longer in charge of the soul. Say, person is coming here for 5 days to follow spiritual exercises. We have graces of state to give spiritual direction to this person during 5 days. God is obliged to protect us. Even if we are obliged to see the girl, for example, I don't know, four or five times a day during 5 days, we are under protection. Okay, because it's according to our duty of state. Suppose, I explain to the priest that as soon as the spiritual exercises are over, you are no longer in charge of the soul. Because you are not the pastor of the soul. By consequence, the soul must go back to her own pastor. Suppose a girl coming, for example, from Seattle, following the spiritual exercises. I have by duty of state, special protections from heaven, to take care of this girl during 5 days retreat. After she's going back to Seattle, she's under Father Rizzo. I have no longer to put my finger on the problem. Suppose I want absolutely to keep contact with her, I'm playing with the fire, and God is no longer obliged to protect me. Except, you have one exception, when it's someone who is under our jurisdiction. Suppose there is, it's a case here, in fact, they have two ladies coming from Miami. Miami is under my jurisdiction because we are in charge of Miami and Florida from here. By consequence, even after the retreat, I have the right to keep contact with them by letter because I'm the pastor of our missions in Florida. Same thing for Father Teg and Father Young. We have jurisdiction on these missions. By consequence, God is obliged to protect us. Okay? These rules are very important. It's because of they don't follow this type of rules now. They are gone. You have any questions with that here?
Yeah. How about retirement for society priests? I found out a priest of the Eastern Rite is living by himself.
In Society of St. Pius X, we retire the day we die.
What happens if you become, let's say, God forbid you get cancer, or you become...
That doesn't change anything in society. We die... Some priests who died already in Society of St. Pius X, for their burial at the cancer committee, were still working. This idea of retirement for a priest is a scandal in itself. This doesn't exist in the church. Yeah, but I remember Father Barriel. You have to see Father Barriel before he died. He was a cadaver on two feet. And Father Barriel, for example, one day I remember, Father Barriel had the custom to spend every night 1 hour in front of the Blessed Sacrament. Each night of his life, from midnight to one. Every day. And I remember Archbishop Lefebvre one day getting almost mad with him because Father Barriel was almost dead. He was going at midnight alone from his room to the chapel in Ecorne. We were always afraid he would fall. And Father Bariel, Archbishop Lefebvre told him, Father, I think you are imprudent. Father Bariel answered, more or less in French, mind your business, I'm getting some graces for Society of St. Pius X. It was to his bishop. It was good. And Father Bariel died like that. He did read all the life of the good priest. So why is that? It's completely modernist to have this idea, I'm 70, 75 years old, I stop. No, a priest can always be used to something. Suppose a priest, for example, I don't know, suppose we have an old priest here with 75 years old, tell me, Father, I cannot walk anymore. He can hear the confession of the retreat. He can help us a great deal. So we say, okay, the people, you can go to his room, he's old, he's 75 years old, he cannot walk, but he can hear confession. You can't hear confession. Of course, you have sometimes some extraordinary case. For example, a priest who is losing completely his mind. Senile, for example. Senile. But God protects that. I don't hear about priests who are losing their mind. Perhaps in the Novus Ordo Church. But it's a case different. In the Novus Ordo Church, they already lost their mind before. But I know two cases in the Society of St. Pius X, Father Lebouche and Father Bariel, both of them dropped when they were so sick, finally they died like that. Oh, both of them. No, it's not the same. It's not the same. Father Lebouche, you have two Father Lebouche in the Society of St. Pius X. And it's exactly the spirit of the Roman Catholic Church. There is no retirement for priests. Your material retirement, say, society is obliged to take care of our priests. Suppose a priest was very sick, was obliged to go to the hospital or something like that. This priest would, of course, be all his expenses would be covered by the Society of St. Pius X. Yes. Yes. Yeah, but Father Monsignor de Courbourget, same thing. He never retired. He retired just before the end when he was incapable to say his mass. He had problem with his fingers, was no longer capable to say his mass, but he was still working. Huh? Yeah, he was still working. Yes. Still working, you know. And Archbishop Lefebvre would do the same. Okay.
Who?
I don't know. I don't know. Father Bariel, for example, his dream was to die preaching a spiritual exercise. He wanted that so badly. He didn't succeed because Archbishop Lefebvre obliged him to go to the hospital. He died at the hospital in Sion, but he wanted. Father Vallée, for example, this one who reduced the month of St. Ignatius from 1 month to 5 days. He died pushing spiritual exercise in 1947 in Madrid. He was. You can see that also in the life of all the good popes. All the good popes died working, more or less. See the life in the life of Saint Vincent de Paul, in Saint John Bosco, all these great saints. No retirement for them. Forget it. No time. Saint John Marie Vianney, yeah, same thing. Okay, well, we stop here. We finish. Question 77 next time, because